keep pace with the leaders on day one of the Donegal International Rally, live on Highland Radio, in association with Pulse Venue Letterkenny, where tonight, Friday, it's Johnny Brady and One for the Road. Pay at the door.
All right, let's get an update over to our head of sport, Oisín Kelly. What's the story, Oisín?
Yeah, well, we're still waiting on the first update, Greg, guys, as from the competitors, because they're not due on the opening stage, Malin Head, for another, what, 3 or 4 minutes. What time is it now? Yeah, it's 11:02, actually 5 minutes time. The first car due is at 11:07, and that, of course, will be the defending champions of Callum Devine and Noel O'Sullivan. The Derry and Kerry partnership are, of course, trying to win this event for 3 years in a row. I'll tell you what, Greg, the weather is tremendous here this morning in Inishowen. I'm just at the end of the Malin Head stage, down in the heart of Inishowen, and it's starting to heat up, and the sun is shining beautifully here in the Inishowen Peninsula this morning, and it's certainly teeing things up for what we hope will be a hugely successful and, of course, safe weekend here in Donegal this weekend.
What's the crowds like, Oisín?
Coming down through, Greg, there was, yes, a lot of traffic on the roads, but it was moving. You will get to your destination, and I suppose the best advice we can give to people who are coming out to this event today is basically get there early. Get under the stage early. Get your spot early. Stay in there for a lengthy period of time, because you really don't have the opportunity to jump from stage to stage to stage. So the best idea is get in early, pick your spot, stay there for a few hours, watch the action, and then maybe in the afternoon, later in the afternoon for the next loop, you can move maybe to a different location. But yes, there was a lot of traffic on the way down to Inishowen. We had the ceremonial start last night, Greg, on the Port Road in Letterkenny. There was huge crowds out for that. The Port Road on the main street was absolutely packed with people and packed with rally cars, and that's been the start now to the event for the last couple of years, and it seems to be working very, very well. And there was lots of people out enjoying the good weather yesterday evening for that ceremonial start, and there was a wonderful atmosphere. So there was a building towards the start of this event, and listen, in the nitty gritty, when we get down to it, when we look at what's coming here now in the next 20 minutes or so, the calibre of drivers, the quality of the cars that they are driving, that they are competing in this weekend. We mentioned Callum Devine and Noel O'Sullivan. There is obviously the likes of John Armstrong and Shane Byrne. John competing for the first time. He's an ERC regular, a European Rally Championship regular competitor. He picked up a podium last week. He's followed by the British Rally leader, that's the championship leader, William Crichton and Liam Regan, competing in a first time in a top level car here in Donegal. They will be third in the road. And then the man that's travelled the furthest for this event, Hayden Padden from New Zealand, is alongside David Moynihan, and he jumped at the chance to compete in Donegal. And if you don't know your motorsport, Hayden Padden is a two-time, a double European champion from the last number of years. He's also won on the world stage as well. And that's the top four crews. And then after that, listen, Josh Moffat's won it before. Marion Evans second last year. Declan Boyle's a former champion. David Kelly got a podium last year. Cahan McCourt's in the new Skoda. Michael Boyle, James Ford, Kevin Eaves. The list goes on. And there is, of course, over 200 crews who will be competing in this event. The main field obviously starts today. We've also to come this weekend. The historics are going to swing into action tomorrow, which has become a very popular side of the event. And then the juniors will be adding their worth as well on Sunday in the final.
So, Oisín, what's the priority today with stage one? Is it for drivers to get the car home and actually sort of, you know, get a feel of it in full on competitive action? Or do the braver ones try and build up something of a lead? You know, from chatting to the drivers and the crews, what generally is the attitude on the first stage in an event of this scale?
Well, that would be the case for the majority of the crews. And listen, they will tell you that they just want to get the feel of the car. They want to bed the car in. This is a marathon event. It's the one and only three-day rally in the country. There's not too many of three-day events left outside of the world and the European stage. Donegal is one of those, and it's seen as a marathon, and people just like to get the feel of the car, the feel of the event, the feel of the stages in the opening stage, the opening loop, maybe the first three stages. But then you've got the seasoned competitors who have been here before. We wait to see what Callum Devine does, because he's won here twice in the last 2 years, looking to make it three in a row. Is Callum just going to bet himself in, or is he going to think to himself, right, hang on a minute here, I'm the champion, I've got a couple of these ERC boys behind me and John Armstrong and William Creighton, Hayden Padden, along with the British leader at the minute, William Creighton, who are all extremely talented drivers. Does Devine think to himself going, right, you're in my backyard here now, maybe I'm going to lay down a marker here and just to let you boys know that I'm not going to give up my title? Or is the rest of them going to say to themselves, well, listen, to flip that around, let's chase down Callum Devine. Let's make our marker on the opening loop here and let everybody know that we're here in Donegal to win this weekend. But that's what's going on at the head of the field. Further on down, there will be the likes of the club men and all the different class competitors who will use... Malinhead's a big stage, Greg. It's a classic, so it is. The scenery is unbelievable. Now, the drivers don't get to see much of the scenery. The fans do.
It goes very quickly.
it goes very quickly, and it's the quality of the stage and the roads, and it's just an iconic Donegal stage, and it's such a big one to start with. Unless when you get into the car and the adrenaline starts, it's very, very hard to hold yourself back and try and bed yourself in. That's the other side of it, so it is. But we wait to see what stage one is going to bring and who's going to be the quickest and who will be the man to go put the hand up and go, right, I want to win this title this year.
So you're in Malinhead now. That's stage one. So could you give us the stages for today?
Yeah. So after Malin, they are going to another famous area of Donegal, which is more so notable for cycling at times because it's been part of different challenges and races. That's Mamore Gap. So the stick rally cars up at Greg, so they do. They go up and down the gap, and that's going to be stage two. And then they're nipping across then to Cool Cross, which is basically between Clonmany. If you took the triangle, Clonmany, Dumfries and Cairn Donna, Cool Cross is stuck in the middle of there. So that's going to be stage three. And they're due on Mamore Gap just after 12. They're due in Cool Cross at 1 o'clock. And then the first main service of the day is going to be 1:30. The cars at the moment are leaving service and making their way out to the start of the Malinhead stage, and they go right up to the very tip of Malin and come down then, and they finish here. We're in the general area of, I'm just looking at my map here, just above the lag, so we are in Malinhead, at the bottom of Malinhead. So that's what's happening today. Malin, Mamore and Cool Cross, they will be done twice, and then the cars are expected back in Park Fermi and Letterkenny at around 10 to 7. Now, just to tee everybody up as well, Greg, we expect big, big traffic delays later on going into Letterkenny. It was a bit crazy last year, so it was.
It's going to
be likewise this year as well. Well, they're leaving. I'm just looking at my sheet in front of me. They're due back in service for the final time today at 16:47, okay, which is near enough 10 to 5. They will leave there and then work their way back to Letterkenny for around about 10 to 7 coming into Park Fermi. But there, as we heard yesterday from the guys that joined you, Greg, to do the preview of this event, there is certain road closures to help the likes of the traffic and the emergency services and the rally organisation and the competitors get back to Letterkenny. They turn off at the dual carriageway and work on their way up through the Cullion Road and back down sort of that area. Mm. So that does assist, I suppose, certain people who are involved in the rally, competing in the rally, and obviously the emergency services. But as for the general public, do expect delays coming in into Letterkenny this evening.
And what's the coverage? Tell us the format of your and Chris's coverage today and through the weekend. Like, when do you... I mean, we want people listening all the time, of course, right? But when are you coming in and out? Is it dependent on when stages finish or if there's a big piece of news? Or when can we keep updated with what's happening over the course of the next 3 days?
Yeah, well, I'm at the end of Malin, and the first car was due on the stage at 11:07, so the course cars, the 00s, are not too far away from us at the moment, and then we'll have the main field working our way there. So I'll be back to you shortly, Greg, with an update end of Malin. After that, we'll be keeping an eye on Mamore Gap, which starts after 12 o'clock, so we'll be... keeping an eye what's happening at the end of there. Now, coverage-wise, down at the end of Mamore Gap is not fantastic, so we'll just have to play up a year there, but we will have an update after two. And then Chris will be there. I'll be leaving here and then going to the end of Cool Cross while Chris will be in service doing interviews. So we're going to have loads of coverage on air for you with rally reports. And then we'll have material as well and pieces of copy, which that will be going up on our website and on our social channels from the service area as well. But there's so many. You have to remember there's over 150 crews starting this rally, Greg, 160 something it is. So they are starting today. So everybody is starting their race today. But as the weekend goes on, we know that's what happens is some drivers drivers go out, some crews go out. There's jostling for places. We have a better idea on the Saturday about who the leaders are and at what place they are. So, like, we could have somebody that's starting maybe 20th on the road today. If we look down through the list, Ryan McHugh, Ryan Loughran, for example, could have a really, really good time in the Smallin Head stage, and he's running, where is he, 28th on the road, and he could have a top three time. So you're waiting that long just for times to come through, and then you get the modifieds as well. So there's a lot to consider now in this opening day of the rally, as all these crews jostle. I'll say that again.
Okay, well, listen, we'll be back to you before 12 to get an update. We'll get some actual sort of senses of a benchmark time, and then it works on from there. Exciting stuff. Thanks,
Arshin
Kelly. Take care of yourself. Bye-bye. Now, we all know that life can get a little, well, cluttered, both literally and figuratively speaking. Our homes, our workspaces, even our minds can sometimes feel overwhelmed by stuff, and it's potentially all interconnected. And that's why I'm delighted to welcome onto the show KonMari consultant and declutter expert, Aidan Gately. Good morning, Aidan.
Morning, Greg. How you doing?
Good. Have you always had a flair for seeing what we don't need and what we do need?
Maybe, yeah. I maybe didn't realise it until I kind of started this career. But as I look back, I kind of think even as a teenager and stuff, I was always quite tidy. But I also kind of felt if my bedroom was kind of in a mess, I kind of felt like my headspace was in a mess, you know? And I don't know which came first, the messy bedroom and then your mind kind of being affected, or vice versa. So yeah, I've always kind of, I think, noticed and felt the value of living in a stress-free, clutter-free space and home.
And Aidan will take your questions, by the way, 086 60 25,000, if you have a question for him. I suppose in the basics, like for me, I do like to declutter, but I'm kind of at the point now whereby I would feel guilty about throwing out some of the stuff that I have. You know, what is there a rule of thumb with the wardrobes or the sock drawer, the knicker drawer, whatever it might be, Aidan?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that guilt is very real, you know? So I suppose to first normalize that, pardon me. And you know, it's normal, but you also, yeah, allow yourself to let it go. When with the KonMari method, we talk about when we're gratefully discarding something. So we try and change our language rather than kind of get rid of something, which sounds kind of negative. So even as you're, and it sounds maybe silly, but even as you're putting the clothes into the bag to donate or even for recycling, just kind of thank it, you know, in your head or out loud. Sorry if you can hear the dog drinking water in the
background.
Don't
worry about that.
So yeah, just kind of thank it for what it gave you. Even if it's something that you never wore, that somebody gave you as a present, but it didn't fit you, you didn't like it, but you kept it out of a sense of guilt because Auntie Mary bought it for you, whatever it is, you know, you kind of have to realize that at some stage, you know, I don't need this thing in my life. It's taking up space in my wardrobe. I'm not wearing it. It doesn't spark joy for me. So let me donate it. Somebody else would get good wear out of it. It's going to charity. It'll make money for a really good charity. And yeah, that kind of helps with that guilt.
Yeah, because I find myself sort of going, well, I'll keep that T-shirt in case I'm painting or strimming, and I'll keep those jeans in case I'm painting or strimming. And it turns out that I've got more of my work clothes that I actually never use than, you know, my everyday clothes. So I need to overcome that.
Keep some stuff. Yeah, of course. I have a shirt for painting, or, you know, boots for just cutting the grass in, you know, but just one kind of each. You don't need, if you start keeping too much, you're never going to use them all.
Are we always honest with ourselves as to why we keep stuff? Like, are there like sights and smells and sounds, either consciously or perhaps maybe more subconsciously for the purpose of this question, do we attribute an emotion to her clothes? Maybe it's that blouse that you wore on the first date with an ex, or whatever it might be, right? Do we do that a lot?
We do that nearly with everything that comes into our lives, or we have it. We can do that, especially with clothes, because they're so personal and you wear them. But like, you know, I have a knife that reminds me of my uncle, you know, so it can be anything. And one person's clutter is somebody else's treasure. And that's why when I declutter with people, I never put something into the recycling or donate box without asking them about it first. Because what looks like crap or rubbish to me is the most sentimental thing for them. So there is, there's so much. And as you say, sight and smells, you know, even just the smell of a scarf or that perfume, you know, if you're walking down the street and you smell somebody's perfume, we're like, oh, that reminds me of an ex or my mom or my aunt or whatever. So it is such an emotional process of, that's why people, I think, find it hard and procrastinate about doing it and feeling overwhelmed, because if it was easy, we'd do it much more readily and easier, you know. But it is, there, we have a tendency to link emotions with people, and especially if it's people who are no longer in our lives or who have passed away, there is a worry that if I get rid of every photograph or every memory of, say, Joan, you know, that will somehow remove Joan's memory from my conscious mind or unconscious, you know. And that's when I kind of help people to realize, like, you know, absolutely keep some mementos that remind you of Joan, but maybe you don't need all her records or all the scarves she ever knit you. You know, maybe you keep the three favorite ones, and maybe they're too itchy to wear, but you hang them where you can see them. They remind you of Joan, but you let go of the rest of the things and know that those memories, they're not in the items, they're in your heart and in your head. You know?
I think sometimes you're not processing things as much as you can if you think surrounding yourself with physical items is the connection. I think there's a process of bereavement or comment in terms grief, of that, yeah, or grief, exactly, that maybe you haven't actually worked on.
You've really jumped right into the nugget of it. Yeah, because the studies and people will say that actually clutter is kind of keeping you, it's either dragging you to the past or it's a fear of the future, you know? And especially with clothes, if it's, you know, you're keeping the skinny jeans because you think you're going to lose weight and become the person you were before, or you're afraid you'll put on more weight, so you're keeping your fat clothes for the future, you know, both of those things kind of trap you. They stop you from living in the present, you know, and there's so much processing that we don't do. And we think if we keep the stuff, it keeps us safe. But actually, if it starts to become kind of a prison, you know, so it's a very psychological process of going through your items and curating what you really actually need and want in your life.
What I find myself doing is just a clean out every now and again. I work up the courage and do it, but that's not, doesn't really align with the KonMari method. So that accepts, does it, that there's a psychological element to this, that you're working on yourself as well as your wardrobe, in inverted commas. The method is which I see as really valuable. So talk me through that and where one might start then if they want to declutter their mind and their cupboards and drawers at the same time.
Exactly, yeah. The full tidying festival, as Marie Kondo calls it. So, yeah, the reason we kind of rebound is because we don't do it fully, or we tidy by location. So we just do the wardrobe or the car or the messy drawer or the attic, whatever. But what the KonMari method does, it simplifies it and makes it slightly less overwhelming by doing it by category. So it's very simple and very strict. We do clothes first. So that's every single piece of clothing that you own in the house or in the car. You bring it all together, even the clothes, you know, the stuff for doing the grass.
What's the rules, though? Because, Aidan, I will find myself item by item making a very reasonable reason as to keep it, even if I haven't worn it for quite some time. So is there can you help us with sort of like a rule or parameters that will break that? Because we could just end up dragging everything to one side of the cupboard. Look, I've got enough more space, but I've chucked nothing out, Aidan.
Yeah, so you have to take everything out, Greg. So if I was in your house and we were doing clothes, we would literally get every single piece of clothing that you own and we pile it up on your bed or the spare bed. And then we have three boxes, keep, donation, recycle right beside. And as you pick up every single item, we're deciding if you want it in your life or not. But before that, I also tell you, I give you permission to keep everything. People never do, but you need to allow yourself to keep everything if you need to. Also, you need to change your frame of mind. When you're looking at that pile of clothes on the bed, don't think, oh God, I have to get rid of all of this or half of this. You don't. What you have to do is go through it and find the things you want and you love and you need to wear for work or whatever. That's your job, is actually to find the things you want, put them in the keep pile. Then everything else that's left on the bed at the end of that is stuff that you don't need, that you don't want, that doesn't fit, that is torn or ripped. And then that goes for recycling and donation.
And that means it's never wasted. Do you find then in that process that to get an item into each box takes a bit of time, but once you've done that, your client then all of a sudden they know exactly which box is for which, because you've broken it's like a wild horse, isn't it? You've broken them. They know what's happening.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that process, it depends on how much. Everybody always asks me, how long is this going to take? How much is it going to cost us?
All right, we've dropped out.
I've had a session.
Okay, go ahead. Yep, sorry, we had a slight blip there. Continue, Aidan.
You're grand. No worries. Yeah, I would usually do a 5-hour session with somebody. And depending on the person, sometimes you will get to every single piece of clothing in 5 hours and restore it. Sometimes it might take 3 5-hour sessions, depending on what they have. But it also depends on the amount of items they have and also how quickly it is to go through them. And my job isn't really to do it the fastest. My job is to work with the client, and if they need to tell a story about every single piece of clothing, that is part of the process, and that will help them let go of what they don't need.
Are shoes problematic?
They can be. Yeah, some people, it's funny, like some people could have jackets. They could have loads and loads of jackets.
Jackets,
23 coats. Yeah,
that's my thing.
But some people could have loads of shoes. Women might have loads of dresses. Somebody, clothes isn't their thing, but paper is their thing. Or somebody could have, you know, 300 books and the next person I go to just has 3 books. I've literally had somebody who's like, the book I'm reading now, the one I just finished and the one I'm about to start, you know, but the next person could have a room of books and boxes and boxes. So everybody is different, you know, but the principle is the same. Again, with shoes or books, we bring them all together and go through them one by one and decide if I love it, if I need it, if I wear it, if I use it.
I don't think I could afford you and my wires drawer, Aidan. You never know, I might buy a Nokia 9010 and need a charger for it. You know what I mean? So get out of my drawer and my red and white cables to a jack.
That's in the kimono category. So that's after clothes, books and paper is miscellaneous. And in that is electrical, and it's that those wires. If you don't know now, obviously in your industry you will know what a jack is and a female HDMI or whatever.
Yeah.
Most people, when they pick up something, if you don't know what it is supposed to charge, if you don't know the lock that this key goes into, you don't need it. Right. And yeah, if you decide to get a 9210 Nokia in 10 years' time, it'll probably come with a free charger.
Aidan's so right. We have a home here and it's packed with bits and pieces, yet we have a holiday home abroad and all we have are the essentials, and it actually feels lighter and brighter.
That's funny. I was just literally talking to somebody about it this morning and I used that analogy. You know, when we go on holidays or go to a hotel, we only bring the bare minimum. So for that person, they just need to kind of try and treat their current home as their holiday home. Do you know, almost like think, well, if I was only coming to this for a weekend or a few weeks or a month, what would I keep in it? Because we do it automatically when we go on holidays. We just bring the things we love and need. And then we can relax. That person is exactly right. When they go to their holiday home, there's a lot less stuff in it. It's only the essentials. It's what they love. They've probably put into the holiday home the things they really love. And then they can relax more in that space. Mm. And what the KonMari method is, and what I try to help with people, is get that feeling, the feeling that that person has in the holiday home. In an ideal world, they should feel that in their everyday home. You know, when the world and life is stressful enough, when we close our front door, I want people to feel, you know, that they can breathe out and their home is a sanctuary and a safe place. Whereas so many people I speak to, actually, when they open their front door, they get stressed, or they actually stay in the car a little bit longer than they need to because they don't want to go in and face what's there.
Yeah, of course, the sentimental items are the hardest to let go of. How can someone honour some memories without keeping every single physical memento? Now, I'm blessed in that my relationship and memories with, say, for instance, my mom and dad and my sister and other people in my life, they're in my head and heart. That's where I feel them. Then you get people who store messages and they'll go through the messages at night and then they keep every physical thing. And you've already referenced this, that in some way, if they get rid of one thing, they think they're doing something wrong. There's something, there's a bigger picture there, isn't there, Aidan?
Yeah. No, there is. And sentimental items are the hardest. And that's why in the KonMari method, especially, they are the last things you come to. And what's sentimental for you and what for me? It could be a chair for somebody, a magnet, a photograph, obviously. So sentimental items we do at the very end because they are the hardest. By the time you get to them, because you've gone through every single other piece of of clothing or possession in your house, it will be easier to go through them.
Okay, I guess.
You will have got better at trusting your gut. You'll have got better at letting go. And then you will maybe look at a pile of things that remind you of people and be like, okay, maybe I don't need as many things to remember this person, you know? And without being too kind of dramatic or maudlin or something about it, it's also, you know, if people have heard of the Swedish act of death cleaning, you know, it's, you know, we all will go into that box or whatever at the end of our lives, and we can't bring those things with us. In the end, it will be the memory. Actually kind of tackle them now, it can make living much more enjoyable because you're not stuck.
A caller says, I have young children and work and struggle to find the time to fully declutter and organise the house. How should I do it? Now, they're clearly making this to be a massive job. And you'll never get round to that, right? But I think decluttering is actually doing a bit of something for yourself. And you can talk now to the method that this person's taking it on as an entire project. Where would you even begin with that? Well, that's where the method comes in.
Yeah, so it depends. You know, if that person has the luxury of time and you know, wants to get me or somebody like me to come up for 3 days in a row, it's amazing how much you can get through in like 3-5 hour sessions. If they don't have that, a lot of people don't have that, then it's breaking it down into just manageable chunks. And, you know, that might mean I don't have the time to put all my clothes on the bed, but let me, maybe tonight I'll just pull out all my jumpers, just your jumpers, just pile them on the bed and go through them and decide which ones you want to keep and not, you know, slowly kind of do it like that. Another really good thing to do is just put an empty box or bag near your front door. And as you're walking around your house today or tomorrow, just look at things. If you see a book, a present that somebody gave you, you've never opened a candle, whatever it is, a scarf, you're like, I never wear that, it's too itchy, put it in that box. And when that box is full, just bring it to donation. Eventually you'll get there. It will take longer. And I suppose the KonMari method is all about trying to do it once and for all so you don't have to keep doing it, you know, because if you kind of do it little by little, you kind of never fully get there, you know. So if you can do it in one go, It's ideal, but it is possible in smaller sections.
And I think also too, even just the way you, and maybe this is not even something you emphasise, but it's the thing that resonated to me, is the recycle or donate piles, because then it doesn't feel like waste. So instantly it doesn't feel like waste, and I don't feel guilty because something good is coming of both of those piles. Just one last question. Do you, you know the draw? You know, it used to be plastic bags and then now it's every blooming thing, right? We all have that one drawer that as soon as you open it, everything pops out like a jack-in-the-box. How do we stop putting stuff into it?
So yeah, clutter is basically homeless items. So that's that drawer is full of things that don't have a home. So take it out now, put it up on your kitchen table and get your bin, get 3 plastic bags of keep, donate and recycle. And it's literally going through it. I did this last week actually at the workshop in Donegal and somebody brought that messy drawer. And we ended up keeping the things she needed in it and get rid of. So we kept the sellotape, we kept the sandwich bags, we kept the ice cubes for the freezer. And they went back into that drawer because that's their home. But we got rid of all the other things that weren't needed. So it's about, because that drawer gets full of, you know, used batteries, new batteries, light bulbs or whatever. It's about finding a place for them. So go through the drawer, get rid of everything that you don't need, and then try and give the other things a home. And even if it's just a home in that drawer, what you'll find is, people think they need more storage or blah, 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 blah. If you just go through every drawer and get rid of what you don't need, all of a sudden what you keep fits in it more and you can find it.
Yeah. And you know what? What goes in that drawer too is a phone charge cable that does work, but it just doesn't quite charge the phone as quick as a new one does. And next thing you know, you don't know which cable's which. Listen, Aidan, lovely to chat to you. I'll let people know how they can get in touch with you. Thanks so very much indeed. Take care. That was Aidan Gately, KonMari consultant and declutter expert. If you wanted to have him up at your house for 5 hours at a time, why not? Just search Aidan Gately.
Keep pace with the leaders on day one of the Donegal International Rally, live on Highland Radio, in association with Pulse Venue Letterkenny, where tonight, Friday, it's Johnny Brady and One for the Road. Pay at the door.
Right, Oisin Kelly, have we anything to report?
Yeah, we do have something to report, Greg. We're here at the end of the Malins stage. The leading crews have just completed the 17.68 kilometres off the first run around this Donegal Classic in very dry conditions. We're told that the air temperature is around 20 degrees in there. The tire temperature is 28 degrees. And we've got joint leaders after the opening stage of this event. The defending champions, Callum Devine and Noel O'Sullivan, and John Armstrong, who's doing this event alongside Donegal's Shane Byrne, have an identical time of 7 minutes 26.8 seconds coming through that Malin test. Devine, of course, in the Fabia that he won last year. Armstrong here in the M Sports supported Ford Fiesta Rally 2, but an equal time. Callum was happy enough with his run, his opening run for this rally, just bedding himself in. So was John. He called it an okay run. So he did coming off Malin, given that he hadn't had much testing done on the tarmac in the car, but both satisfied with their opening times. We're all keeping an eye on Hayden Padden and David Moynihan. Padden, of course, the two-time ERC champion, and is not too far off the pace. Just 1.9 seconds adrift, almost 2 seconds slower. 7:28.7 was the time there for Hayden Padden, who said coming off the stage that it was tricky, very bumpy in there in Malin, and he's just finding his feet, of course, with his Hyundai i20 here in Donegal. David Kelly, who finished third last year with Arthur Cairns on board in their Volkswagen Polo, they had the fourth fastest time of 7:29.9 and just 0.3 of a second behind them was the first of the Yaris cars, Marion Evans and Jared Conway. They finished runners up last year. They wrap up the top five. Outside of that, Josh Moffat and Andy Hayes, they had the sixth quickest time, 7:33. Josh saying as he came off the stage that the tires started to go off a bit towards the end. Then we have William Creighton and Liam Regan, seventh overall in the Yaris, 7:33.5 was the time there. 6.7 seconds slower than the leading duo, and William just wasn't happy with that opening stage. He says he's got a bit of work to do. It's very bumpy in there in Malin, and he's going to try and reset now for the next stage. So the rest of the top 10 unofficially is Declan Boyle and Patrick Walsh in the Skoda 8th. Michael Boyle and Dermot McCafferty are in 9th. They were separated by just 1.7 seconds in there in Malin, and James Ford and Neil Shanks, the Crosswater visitors in the Citroën C3, are wrapping up the top 10 at the moment, with the likes of Kevin Eaves sitting in 12th, Joseph McGonigal's 14th, Aidan Ray 15th, Matthew Boyle 16th, Ryan McHugh in 17th, and we're still waiting on the modified times and the crews to come our way here at the end of the stage. But I can tell you Cahan McCourt has lost a lot of time in there due to a puncture. It's his first run out in the Skoda Fabia R5, and his time was 11:58, so he's lost a lot of time, 4.5 minutes down on the leaders. Who after stage one are Callum Devine and Noel O'Sullivan in the Skoda, the defending champions, and John Armstrong and Shane Byrne, they are sitting equal on 7:26.8 as they head to stage two, Greg, which is Mamore Gap, and they're due on stage there at about 12:10, and we'll be back with another update real soon from the Wilton Recycling Donegal International Rally, which is reveling already in the sun after just one stage for the leaders.
Thank you very much, Oisin. Cole McMeehan joins me after these. Cole McMeehan, owner of Meehan Travel World Choice and Sean Meehan Chartered Valuation Surveyors in Bundoran's with me in studio as we reflect on your retirement. You're going to retire in August. Cormac, what a career.
Good morning, Greg. It's nice to be here. Yes, I've enjoyed a very fruitful and promising career over a period of almost 40 years. So I felt it's time to move along to perhaps the next chapter. I've enjoyed every moment of my time in business as self-employed individual, but it's I think it's time to move on. There's about so much that you can give, and I think I've given enough at this stage.
It's been time for a bit for yourself, indeed. You took over the business in 86, 87 after your father, who started the business in 1950, passed away. Was the pressure at that point to step into his big shoes, I suppose? There was
To a degree, Greg, but I was working at the time in what was the RTC in Letterkenny, now the ATU,
okay.
And I was lecturing there for a period of 2 years. So his death happened quite suddenly. He was 60 at the time. So he didn't have the opportunity to retire. but myself and my bride-to-be at the time decided that it was a good move to go back and to make the most of the business and try to grow it over a period. And we did, and we never looked back after that.
And what was the marriage of travel and auctioneering?
It's an interesting story, Greg. It started in the 50s, and what happened was that my dad was an estate agent at the time, and he was selling farms. There was a lot of emigration after the war in South Donegal and all places. Mm-hmm. So he was asked to sell properties for people that were emigrating to the US or to the UK. And what happened then was people didn't know where they could source a boat ticket or a plane ticket at that time. There was one shipping agent in Sligo, and my dad used to drive to Sligo to buy the tickets from the shipping agent for the people he was selling the properties for. And he'd get paid for the tickets when the property was sold. So that was the nexus of it. And the man in Sligo said to him one day, "Sean, why don't you go ahead and open your own agency, because you're doing nearly more business than I am at this stage." So that was the start of it, Greg. It's a good story.
Yeah, indeed. And that's really the most basic early part of sort of being a travel agent, isn't it? Driving to Sligo physically.
They call it vertical integration in business.
Yes, they do now in any case. And of course, you know, you've been involved in your business, but also in helping steer and represent the business through your presidency of the Irish Travel Agents Association. And also, you were president as well of the Irish Auctioneers and Valuers Institute, were you?
Yeah, I was. I always got involved in the organisations that controlled our businesses, simply because I felt that the needs of rural practitioners in many instances were not being represented at a national level. So I felt a sort of my moral compass was pointing in that direction, and I enjoyed networking with co-professionals, both in the travel sector and in the property sector. And indeed, it was very beneficial in being able to grow my business, because I had a network of contacts right around the country and even in certain parts of the world. So it was a very beneficial time. And I have had a very good staff of three in the office, so they were well able to manage and cope in my absence and were exceptionally supportive, together with my wife, of my efforts to get involved in the organisational side of the business.
If you think of how your dad started, you know, he was answering a question or solving a problem. You know, I want to go somewhere, and where do I even begin to do that? Nowadays, you can source your own flights, you can go to booking.com and organise accommodation and all that. So you would think, well, who needs travel agents anymore? We know everything. But that's hasn't proven to be the case. It wasn't the death knell, because there's so many pit holes and potential problems there that many, many people still want to go and get trusted advice and the support and the backstops of a travel agent.
There have been events in the world economy over the last 40 years, ranging from tsunamis in Southeast Asia, the 9/11 incidents, COVID more recently, and other various events right around the world. And people have understood, and they know that travel can be a very volatile product. Now, the situation that if people have to sit down from A to Z to plan and organise their trip, people have begun to put a premium on their time, particularly younger consumers. Mm-hmm. So they're quite happy to commission somebody to do that work for them. In addition to that, they feel that the adaptability of the arrangements they make with a high street travel agent gives them the opportunity to be flexible, and they can tailor make their stuff. It's a very much a people-centred business, and human contact is exceptionally important.
Yes, and it's a relationship based on trust. So if someone says this is good, if you've got a 3 and 4 year old, you don't feel that you potentially could be wasting your trip, as it turns out not to be the case. So I think people like that element of it as well. Is 9/11 and COVID have been the biggest fluxes in the business?
Certainly COVID was, because we were effectively closed, as were most agents, for a period of almost 2 years.
And we never knew how things were going to come back.
We never knew how things were going to come back. No, there was no manual written about how to cope with something like this.
Sure.
But I think the important point was that the vast majority of us managed to keep our teams together. We dealt with the public in terms of getting them the refunds from the airlines that they had booked with. And that built another layer of trust in terms of the retail business. And it has done the world of good for many of us in terms of how we balance our lives and our businesses.
And as it turned out, those who had the resources could not wait to get travelling again. And we saw things bounce back far quicker than the experts, in inverted commas, had told us. Things have changed greatly in terms of social media, how you interact with people, how people spend their money and all this kind of stuff. But has the fundamental, is it the fundamentals that have stayed the same? So in other words, the core element of the business from when you began, is that the same now, and it's the stuff around it that maybe that has changed dramatically?
The core element of both businesses has been people and relationships and the capacity to maintain and keep those active and alive. Every day in both the travel and the property business is different. Every client's needs are different. And you have to develop a skill to understand those needs and be prepared to fulfil them. And if you can't, know how they can be fulfilled elsewhere. So you're essentially giving, you're the last port of call for many people. So you have that core responsibility and expertise to help them in every way you possibly can.
Have we seen a period in the property market before that we've seen now in your decades of experience in terms of maybe a shortage, the costs, the fact that there seems no end in sight? You know, I think we could all feel that we could all, the ticking time bomb of property was very evident. I think just, you know, as we approached the recession, we seem to be maintaining now and we're still doing well. We've got more savings than we ever had. The amount we're borrowing is much less, right? So, but in terms of getting property, how much property is changing hands and all, is this unique where we're at the moment?
It's unique in the point of view that the supply has dropped completely. But when you think back to when I came in the late 80s, the big challenge then was interest rates.
Mm,
and interest
15,
rates for residents were up on 22 and 23%.
Right, okay.
So that was a challenge. And it meant that people were really pressed and they were afraid of the market. The banks were quite aggressive in terms of repossessing properties. And the market was dropping drastically at the time. So it was a no-win situation for everybody. But there have been about three of those troughs during my career. And they all have been characterised by people's incapacity to manage their financial situations. Mm. And we still haven't really got to the point where we have developed models that will sustain people through that process.
Mm.
As some of your early guests said, the system is broken and we need to work hard at fixing it.
Yeah. I don't think you've ever really had spare time, have you? Between running two businesses, then seeking the presidency and successfully acquiring them of the two heads of the businesses. And then, you know, the work you do in terms of voluntary work, be either local or national. In other words, all of your time sounds like, right, it's always been accounted for. You will have more time now, or are you going to replace your busy workload now with other stuff? Like, what do you intend to do post-August?
Well, I've always enjoyed walking and running. And over the last 10 years, I concentrated on getting myself fitter again and again. And one of the greatest joys I had was over a business year, I decided to have an ambition to run a 5K in every single European country, which I did over 12 months. And it culminated in November in Turkey, where I did a 5K on the European side of Istanbul and then on the Asian side. So I actually ran in
two continents
yes. in one weekend. So I'm enjoying, I enjoy being active, and together we do an awful lot of walking. I'll enjoy to travel. And there's an aspect to my career that I do a certain amount of arbitration work for the High Court. And I'm retaining that for another few years because it's stimulating and I enjoy it. And I work with four other colleagues to resolve disputes around the country. And we're a good team, and they only call us if things are really bad. So it's a nice future, and I'm looking forward to it.
You know, your name's over the door. You're the face of the business. But to be successful for as long as you have been successful in both the property field and the travel field requires people having your back. People you can rely on, people that can step in when they need to. How important has the team been over the span of the last number of decades?
The team has solidly been Kathleen McDade, Fiona Feely and Caroline McNamara. And they're the three that have been with me the longest, a collective service of about 100 years, would you believe? But again, they work as a team. Over the years, I've never heard their voices raised or a crossword in the office. And it's the sort of office that where the phone rings...
Well, you never listen, do you?
But when the phone rings, the person nearest it answers it. There's no prima donnas.
Yeah.
And of course, my wife Maureen has been the backbone to everything that I've done over the years.
And what happens to the businesses now? Do they wind down with you or are they continuing in one form or other?
Unfortunately, they're not. They're being wound down at the moment. And that's a situation that faces many people who are self-employed, because, and particularly in service businesses, you don't have transferable or marketable assets.
But you can't sell the shop.
Yeah, yeah. But by the same token, I think there's probably opportunities for people who want to expand their businesses in that area. And I have had approaches from people who are interested in that sort of an approach. But I'm drawing a line firmly under the retail side of my participation.
And how do you feel about it, lastly?
Well, the hardest decision we made was to make the decision to retire.
Yes.
And the day that Maureen and I decided, the next challenge was to talk to the staff.
Yeah.
And I remember it was a Tuesday evening, and I sent them on the group WhatsApp message. I said, come in at 9:30 tomorrow morning. I have a little thing I want to talk to you about. And I'm sure the three girls were bricking it over the overnight, wondering what was they going to talk to them about. But when I explained the rationale and what we were going to do and how we were going to do it, they were delighted, and they're all happy at the moment.
Well, Cormac, listen, the very best of luck to you. I'm sure we'll cross paths again in the media and otherwise. Really enjoy your retirement. Congratulations on a wonderful career in many areas, and also well done for all the efforts that you've put in a voluntary capacity, you know, the work that you do. But Cormac, thanks so much for chatting to us.
Thanks a million, Greg.
Cormac Meehan there, owner of Meehan Travel, Word Choice and Sean Meehan Chartered Valuation Surveyors in Bundoran.